From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today we focus on two issues in the U.S. military. The Missing in America Project is a unique program that identifies the cremains of unidentified veterans from past wars. And thanks to the program, some of these veterans are now receiving a proper burial. We'll hear from the director of the Missing in America Project and Iowa's state coordinator for the project. Then we listen back to a conversation I had with West Point graduate Lieutenant Dan Choi. Choi became an activist after being discharged under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which was repealed a few days ago. That's all coming up this hour. First, let's look at the hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on our program, we focus on two different aspects of the U.S. military. Later in the hour, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We listen back to a conversation I had with Lieutenant Dan Choi. Choi is a former American infantry officer who became an activist after being discharged under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. That in the second half hour of our program. But first, a look at a unique program identifying the cremains of unidentified veterans from past wars. In this half hour, a conversation with Fred Sulanti, director of the Missing in America Project, also Bill Lackland, a veteran of the U.S. Air Force, and Iowa's state coordinator for the Missing in America Project. Together, they're working to see that unidentified veterans are given a proper burial. My colleague, Iowa Public Radio's Lindsay Moon, talked with the two men about their project.
Fred Sulanti, I'm going to start with you. You are the director and founder of the Missing in America Project, which you launched in 2007 in January. Tell me a little bit about the project. What is it?
Well, the project is about finding veterans that have been, for a number of circumstances, abandoned in funeral homes, cemeteries, mental hospitals, and these people have no family or next of kin that can speak for them. And so under most laws in the states, the organization that has them cannot do anything with them without a voice to speak for them. So our project has started to be the voice for those that can't speak for themselves.
What brought it to your attention that there's a need for something like that?
Well, what brought it to my attention was I was going to a VA National Cemetery in Eagle Point and saw that once a month they had a service for people that had either no money or no family to attend a military honor service. And so I went there, and there was 33 veterans being buried. And there was myself, a chaplain, and a one person from the cemetery, and it just struck me that this wasn't right.
When it first occurred to you that there were all of these veterans that didn't have anyone to claim them and weren't receiving proper burials, how did that make you feel?
It made you feel that this couldn't be. Somewhere the system let everybody down, and when all of us signed up, especially me be a veteran myself, you didn't sign up to be left on a shelf or abandoned. We signed up to be buried with our peers in a VA cemetery with other soldiers and or with family. So you feel like it has to be corrected.
When you found out about that, did you just have the idea to start a project like the Missing in America?
No, what I started to do is just to gather people together to come and be present and stand with a flag line. And at the time, I was on the national support staff of the Patriot Guard Riders, and I was in charge of projects that were on the West Coast for the nine western states. So I started calling every cemetery to see if this happened other places. And lo and behold, I get to Idaho, and they have an additional, aside from the people that were in the situation I just mentioned, they had a funeral home that was bought by somebody else that had just turned in 20-some veterans. And so they were going to try to work in Idaho to get some laws passed to protect this. And so then I started calling other states, came to Nevada. Nevada had 34 veterans that were in exactly the same position. And so at that same time, the Oregonian published the story about the 3,600 cremains in the Oregon Mental Hospital that had been there since 1891 to 1971. And they shut the hospital down in 71, but here's 3,600 copper cans of people and of which a lot would have been veterans. In our normal situation, we find that 10 to 30% of all of the people we find on a shelf turn out to be a veteran. And so that means 350 to 1,000 veterans are in the Oregon State Hospital that should be buried properly. So that told me this wasn't an isolated problem. And so then we then incorporated and expanded to take this from being one state to get laws to every state in the nation, and hopefully to get enough recognition that the federal government sets up a program that lets this happen and on a permanent basis. So first of all, nobody ends up on the shelf that way. And two, when they do, there's a way to get them off and do the same thing that we're doing.
Why is there such a high percentage of veterans that are never claimed?
Well, I think there's lots of reasons for that. I think a lot of times it's veterans and service people that have a most dysfunctional family and the fact that they're moving and separated from family members. So I think sometimes there's an issue with that. I think the other thing is that most of the veterans, and I'm sure this is the case in the Oregon State Mental Hospital, is that there's a whole bunch that have PTSD, that have other issues, that isolate themselves from family and come back and things aren't the same, so they take themselves and remove it and they go to places that then there's nobody that knows their background or relatives.
When you decided to start the Missing in America Project, what did it take to start it up and get people involved with it? How did you get the word out about it?
Well, like I say, at the time I happened to be involved with the Patriot Guard Riders, and we started putting the word amongst that organization that started then getting states that wanted to help and people and individuals. The problem there became that the issue is that when you are going to accept and be the legal person for these veterans, you have to have a whole different liability issue, insurance issues, and other problems, and that then made the Missing in America Project have to separate and go on its own to protect everybody concerned.
And since then, you've expanded the program, so there's now a branch looking for these veterans in funeral homes in almost every state. And I'm going to turn to you now. Bill Lachlan, you are the coordinator for Iowa's branch of the Missing in America Project. When did you get involved with the program?
A little over three years ago when I saw Fred on TV and what he was doing. I couldn't believe what was happening. So I dug into it, and it just felt right for me to do it, and I did it.
And you are a Vietnam vet. How did you react to finding out that there were all of these veterans that were just in copper containers?
I was disgusted. How can that happen? I mean, here we are, the greatest nation in the world, and we're let our veterans sitting on shelves, unclaimed, and they deserve better.
As the coordinator for Iowa's branch of the Missing in America program, what does your job entail?
Well, we contact the funeral homes either by mail, by phone, email, however, to try and get an answer from them, to have them check their inventory, to see if there are any veterans or people they suspect to be veterans. And then they give us that information. We confirm that they are a veteran. And we give them the military funeral that they were promised.
And when you say that you confirm that they are veterans, how do you go about finding information like that?
Well, we do get service records. We work closely with the Veterans Cemetery here. They do a lot of checking. And also with Jefferson Barracks, we have an outlet there that we can contact and make the confirmation.
And the people who are making these confirmations, are they all volunteers?
We are volunteers with MIAP, but Jefferson Barracks is national storage for records for the military. And so they're all soldiers, and they're actual active soldiers.
And once you get confirmation that these people are soldiers and you go about starting to plan a burial for them, what does that process entail?
Well, first we try and locate any family that they may have. We do searches and see if we can find any next of kin or relatives. If we can't do that, then we contact the National Cemetery, the Veterans Cemetery, and we work with them to set up dates for the funeral or interment or interment.
Who pays for the cost of the burial?
The government does. We're all promised when we sign that piece of paper, we're promised a headstone, a flag, and a hole in the ground.
And when you go and try to locate next of kin for some of these veterans, do you ever find families?
We try. The first one I had here in Iowa 3 years ago was William Eugene Stevens. he had put some false information on his paperwork because he wanted to be estranged from his family and not have anything to do. He had the problems, like Fred was saying, you know, PTSD, and he just wanted nothing to do with his family. They hadn't anything or heard anything from him for over 4 years. But anyway, we buried him. It was in the newspapers and on the news and the TV. And the next day I got a call from his sister, who just thanked us for honoring Gene the way we did. And they invited me to a memorial service. I met his mom, sisters, cousins, aunts, and uncles. They had no idea what had happened to him. And then when they found out through the news what we had done, they were at peace. They had closure.
And how does that make you both feel that you're able to provide that for some of their families?
Well, for me to do it, it's an honor. Serving my brothers and sisters that they can't help themselves. And that it just makes me feel so good.
And Fred?
I think it's basically the same thing. I think that when some of us had such a bad experience with our return from Vietnam and watching other veterans for a period in our history that they weren't appreciated, and that's not the case now, but the case now is that it makes us feel that we can accomplish something, that we don't have to brush it, we don't have to hide back, we can stand forward, stand proud, and say that we're veterans and helping other veterans.
On a national scale, Fred, how many veterans have you identified and buried?
Well, I think the total right now is about 1,052 veterans that we've actually interred. We have about 1,400-1,500 that have been identified. We have 6,000 some lists of cremains of names of people that are in the process of being researched. And when we say this, you have to put this in perspective that we visited maybe 1,100 funeral homes across the nation. There are 54,000 funeral homes to visit. So by no means has this project even scratched the surface or even attempted to go forward. And, of course, the first years of our development have been to try to establish a rapport and a credibility that lets the funeral industry and the VA say these guys are reputable. We're going with what the same method to keep the family's information secure. We're giving the same honor and respect and treatment that they would receive from the funeral home in conjunction with everything. So we have stepped up a level in being accepted as part of the industry that is dealing with this problem and doing it in the right way. And that's what it's taken.
Once all of the veterans that remain to be identified are identified and buried, do you foresee a time in the future when there wouldn't be a problem with them just sitting on shelves and people would be identified?
The problem is that when we originally started this project, I estimated with a gentleman who had 40 years in the VA cemetery system that maybe we would find 10 to 15,000 veterans. And maybe we would find a couple hundred thousand cremains across the nation. I think for the fact that Missouri had two funeral homes give us 2,400 names of cremains to research, and you add this time 54,000 different funeral homes, I think there'll be many years before we're done with that project. And I think the other thing that happens is that then from finding the veterans, we are also trying to identify the wives of veterans, the children, dependent children of veterans. We have a case out west where we have a home that took care of kids with autism or special needs kids. They have six children that are in their 20s and 30s that are still authorized dependents. We have to go to those places. So if you add up the women and the children and all of the names, I expect we're going to find 2 to 3 million names that we will have to research. And we will probably bury 150 to 200,000 veterans by the time this is done. So this isn't a short-term objective or a short-term program.
With all of those names, how do you think it was possible that they fell through the cracks and ended up like that in the first place?
Well, there's many reasons why it happens, and a lot of it is the simple fact that I said before that there are state laws that makes the funeral homes or the cemeteries not able to release that information. It's taken us the years that we've done to get 15 states to change laws that will even let them release the information to us to investigate. So That's where it happens, and people. We had a case in Michigan this year where we buried a gentleman. We found his wife, who was in an assisted living facility, and she was 93 years old. 68 years ago, they had a service for their husband, and she thought that he was buried and gone. Instead, he was still on a shelf. And so they were very happy that they thinking that everything was taken care of, and yet we're still finding him. We have went to funeral homes out here that we have taken everybody off the shelves, and we thought we were clear. And 3 years later now, we've already got 30 more to come back and research. Until we get the law stopped at the front end, we're still adding people up, even though we're taking them out at the end process.
What laws need to be changed?
What happened in California recently is we passed a law that says that we now have a member of a Veterans Remains organization, which is us. They're appointed in every county in the state of California. There's 58 counties. We will now have a county representative that works with the county coroner, has the availability when everybody is deceased, that we check their records immediately. There will never be a veteran that gets buried in a pauper's grave again. And we now have access to death certificates and stuff that has been a big stumbling block for us to work. So we need a law similar to that, is that we actually become a semi-volunteer county official. We work inside as people are deceased now. We work it. We stop it. We don't let anybody get on the shelves. And even when they do, they're already identified as a veteran. And after 1 year, we then take them off the shelf and bury them, family or not.
Those laws that he was just talking about in California, what do those look like in Iowa?
Well, we don't have any stumbling blocks as far as identifying. We can get that information. The biggest thing is for them to be notifying us. You know, people. For one instance, Missouri, we just buried our first Civil War veteran. He died in 1918. His wife died in 1923, and they both sat on a shelf since then, and 87, 90 years. We want the law to change, say that when the person is there, they must contact our organization or an organization like ours and say, hey, we have a veteran. We need to bury him.
Is there a law like that in any state right now, Fred?
Now we have that in New York and California are solid, and 15 states have laws that some of those don't set a time limit. And we're saying that the time limit should be 1 year to 5 years, and if anybody's over 5 years on a shelf, they have to give it. And so there is some of that now, but it's very slow. We still got 48 states to get really good laws in yet.
Phil Lachlan, Iowa's coordinator for the Missing in America Project. Do you foresee there being something like that?
We're trying to get that here locally, but we're also pushing federally to get it a federal law so everybody will be covered, every state. And Fred is working on that, and we're working with some congressmen, and we're trying to get that through the House now. Just need support.
How is that being received in Congress and in the legislature right now?
If I'm not mistaken, Fred, we have, what, seven congressmen that are backing
nine,
that?
Nine sponsors
nine
now.
Nine sponsors now.
The problem is that it has now gone past, now that the Congress is ready to stop here, when it starts for next year, we really need to put it in and resubmit it. It's H.R. 2642. But if a bill doesn't get 20 to or more sponsors or get more national attention, they just kind of languish in the shelves. And unfortunately, for the federal portion of our law, that is what's happened. It languished for now about 18 months. And so I think we have to go forward, as Bill said, with some new a new bill that's a little bit more refined along the lines that I just said with the California and New York laws that allows us to stop everything from the front as well as the back. So I'm looking at right now at putting a new bill forward.
Fred, when you started the project, did you ever think that it would expand to include almost every state in the country?
Yes. I didn't have a doubt that it not only will entail every state in the country. We've had interest, and we've had, of course, a connection with Canadian soldiers. We have one in here in California that was a Canadian soldier that we buried here under the same circumstances, and we gave him a very honorable burial in the same thing in Missouri. We've had an American soldier that went and joined the Canadian Army. So anybody that was an ally of us in any conflict is eligible under the VA rules to be buried as well. So not only are we going to be national, we will be kind of semi-international. And I don't think there's any question that if it's happening in one state, it has to be happen in all 50 states, and whatever laws apply have to become a standard to a certain degree for all 50 states. There's no way you can select one out from the other and leave them there.
Bill, as Iowa's coordinator for the project, what is your overall goal? What are you hoping to accomplish?
I'm hoping to get them all off the shelves and get the laws changed so they don't end up there anymore. But if I could say, you know, we're all volunteers. We do get some donations from, well, a lot of people put a few bucks here, a few bucks there. And the biggest thing is we are volunteers. And a lot of the times we need a lot more resources than we have available.
When you say you get donations and it is a nonprofit, you guys are volunteers, what does that money go towards?
It goes towards advertise our we have a newsletter. We have we do different things. Fred's done a lot of things as far as helping soldiers and families of soldiers. He just did a big dinner for soldiers. I think they had enough food for 1,500. And that all came from donations. But we are trying to further ourselves as far as letting everybody know we're here. We are doing this and why we're doing it. And the biggest thing is to get the word out what's happening. It's a crime, and we want to correct it. We don't want the brothers and sisters of us veterans sitting out there on shelves just collecting dust. It's not right.
I think to go to your question too, Lindsay, is that, for example, in some states like California, we have to pay a burial permit fee. Sometimes you have to buy an urn. Sometimes you have to have the transportation to be able to move or get a coach to move somebody. Or in some cases, like the case of New York now, we've got 59 veterans to bury at one time. There's expenses involved with that. I think the interesting fact that people should know is that I just redid our numbers on accountability for money to submit for the combined federal campaign. And a Missing in America project, 99.2% of our money goes to to the veterans and to the cause we specify. And there's only a 0.08% administrative cost. As Bill said, there's nobody with a salary, nobody that's doing everything. We've all spent every bit of gas money, every bit of motel money, every bit of travel money is coming out of our own volunteer pockets. And so our project works hard on people that give us the small $10, $20 donation, and that's all we've gotten for the whole time we've been there. We have nobody that has really came through as a major sponsor for us.
Bill, how many veterans did you say had been buried so far in Iowa?
We've had 10. We did one 3 years ago, then we had 7 that we found together. And then just last year, we buried a World War II veteran. So we've had 10 all total.
Bill Lachlan, Iowa State Coordinator for the Missing in America Project, and Fred Solanti, the Director and Founder of the Missing in America Project. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
My colleague, Iowa Public Radio's Lindsay Moon, with that conversation. To learn more about the Missing in America Project, go to www.miap.us. Coming up, we listen back to my interview with Lieutenant Dan Choi, a former American infantry officer who became an activist after being discharged under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, a policy that was overturned just a few days ago. That coming up in a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lieutenant Dan Choi has been a vocal critic of Don't Ask, Don't Tell since he was discharged from the Army after revealing he was gay on The Rachel Maddow Show in 2009. A 2003 graduate of West Point, he was one of 8 who majored in Arabic language. He served with the 10th Mountain Division in South Baghdad as a platoon leader, a company executive officer, and battalion and brigade staff officer. But after revealing his sexual orientation, he was discharged and began a public campaign for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, crisscrossing the country on speaking engagements. It was on one of those trips that I spoke with Dan Choi. Congress voted this month to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy that effectively closeted gays and lesbians serving in the military, and we thought it would be a good time to listen back to Choi's story as he told it to us in November 2009. I began by asking him whether he had made a conscious decision to disclose his sexual orientation on national television.
The original reason for going on the Rachel Maddow show, we first of all didn't know that we were going to be so public when we started our group of West Point graduates. At the time, there was 25 of us that got together and said, we need to let everybody know that we exist. All we really wanted to do was to tell West Point and other folks in the Army that when Don't Ask, Don't Tell gets repealed, we're there for the transition and to hold your hand through it. We were really there to help the Academy and anybody who might have had some discomfort or some fears about it. But there were a lot of people that messaged me and others in the organization and said, I thought I was alone. I thought I was the only one. And some people said that they were about to commit suicide. They said they were about to drive their Humvees off of cliffs. Or my straight friend in Korea said that one of her soldiers, who she knew was a lesbian, wasn't eating, was so depressed. And then she just let them know that we existed. And there was this newfound hope. And so when I heard messages like that, I realized, okay, well, we have to let people know that they are not alone. And so for me personally, the message has shifted. And being able to tell a wider audience, so, well, what's the most important thing that people need to know? And so I said, well, number one, they need to know that the law, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, is absolutely immoral.
After you did that in March of 2009, when and how did you get word from the military that this would be a problem?
It wasn't anybody that was in my unit that made an issue out of it. Actually, I went to the drill weekend afterward. That is, we do all of our military training. I'm in an infantry unit. And a lot of people, they just, for me, it was very surprising because some people warned me, hey, it's probably going to get a little bit rough for you because you just came out so publicly, and these are a lot of my gay friends, and they were saying, watch out or be on guard or whatever. And they assumed that there was a lot of homophobia and I would be discharged very quickly. Well, that didn't happen for at least a month afterwards, and people in my unit said, hey, sir, just in case you think we don't know, because nobody's talked about it during the training.
It was hush-hush for a long time.
Yeah, nobody really brought it up. Hmm. And there was nobody that was protesting or quitting the Army. There was nobody that was so uncomfortable that they called their congressman or anything. Nobody brought it up as an issue. But I got a letter from a three-star general in Georgia who's in charge of the entire Army National Guard, and he said that I disrupted the unit discipline and good order of the entire New York Army National Guard.
Did he cite any specific instances?
No, actually, everybody in the chain of command that testified at my trial, which happened in late June, they were asked, was there anybody that actually quit? Was there anybody that just lost their military bearing? Was there anybody that quit in protest? Was there anybody that made an issue of this? And the answers across the board were no, no, no. There's no evidence. So for them to posit that I disrupted good order and discipline, that's not so much an insult to me, but it's an insult to the good order and discipline of the unit. My unit, my group, was completely disciplined. They had no qualms about it. Some people came up to me and they said, look, what you're doing is great. We support you because we know gay people in the unit and they need somebody to stand up for them.
Mm-hmm. So in your trial in June, the outcome was a discharge. What's your status?
Well, the recommendation was for discharge. And they told me that the only way that I could prevent that recommendation from being made was to lie. I could have said every single time that I said I am gay, I was joking, or I was lying. So any permutation of my lying would have got me to stay in. the military.
They wanted you to lie because, I mean, you're actually very, very valuable as trained, majored in Arabic. You're one of the few, especially in our day and time, or our time now,
right.
Very valuable, right?
Of course. And, Ben, I wanted to remind everybody, you know, there's only a handful of Arabic linguists in our military, and there's already been, under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, 60 of us who have been kicked out. I'm not even counting that because I'm not fully kicked out yet. But I gave part of my testimony in Arabic, and so the officers needed me to translate that afterwards because there's nobody in the entire building that can translate the Arabic into English. But I wanted to point out also that for those people who are told that they should lie, and there was a lot of people, including lawyers, that advised me, all you have to do is just say basically that you really didn't mean it, I didn't really want to come out, or basically all of these half-truths. That would have allowed me to stay in. But think about this, Ben. If you are an interpreter and you are somebody in Iraq that puts their career or their paycheck or their rank or pension or any of these things in front of and a higher priority than telling the truth, then how can you trust somebody to actually be correct in their translations of what's important? For instance, if a commander needs to know if somebody's a terrorist and the translator, and we have a lot of translators in Iraq who are just afraid to correctly translate some messages because they might upset the other party or their career might be on the line. That is a cause for danger, and that is a huge risk to our armed forces and those soldiers that are serving overseas. What you want are those soldiers, those interpreters, those translators who are not afraid to put it all on the line.
As an Arabic language expert in the Army, what was the nature of your work in regards to Iraq?
In the military, in Iraq particularly, it's what we call a counterinsurgency. There are people in Iraq and in Afghanistan, for that matter, who are against the new government. They're called insurgents, and we are there to essentially quell a riot or quell an insurgency, an insurrection. And what's important in that kind of an operation is to tell the entire population and our allies and those people that we are people you can trust, that you can work with. So you'd find even infantrymen are getting now into the business of reconstruction work and rebuilding sewage and water and electricity and schools and forms of government in the city council level or dealing with tribal leaders. So I, as an infantry officer, I wasn't getting paid for any of my Arabic translations. I did that all for free. I did all that because I have a degree in Arabic from West Point, and when the time came to use it, I said, well, I have this skill. I'm going to use it for the mission.
Including your time at West Point, you served honorably for 10 years under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I wonder, in day-to-day military life, what are the biggest challenges for a gay person in the military operating under this policy?
Well, number one, I never had a relationship, a love relationship, no boyfriend, no girlfriend, the entire time. Throughout West Point, throughout Army training, throughout my service, and throughout my deployment. And
when I because of the policy, or just it just happened so?
Well, Don't Ask, Don't Tell forces people who are gay not only to keep it quiet, but to be celibate and to not have love relationships. If I were to have a relationship and somebody found out about it, that would be called homosexual conduct. Now, under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I would be allowed to go to a gay bar, or I would even be allowed to march in a gay pride parade and even be a part of these action groups. It's just when I say things like I'm gay, for instance, if I said it to my mom or my dad, that would be illegal. And I always joke around and I say that, you know, that I've only told three people, my mom, my dad, and Rachel Maddow. But all of those were equally as illegal.
In your time in the military, do most of your fellow soldiers know that you were gay? Do people commonly know who is gay in a unit and who is not?
People who will let you know that everybody, whether they're open about it or not, but there are a lot of people in their units who are openly gay, and they tell their, and particularly together, and harrowing experience, and you're getting to know each other in your personalities, and for instance, friends and their wives, and we would have a bowling night together, or we would go out to the bar together, and I would get to know them on a very personal level, and they wanted to know about me. And when I started my first relationship, when I got back from Iraq, I kept talking about my quote-unquote girlfriend, and I said that Matthew was actually Martha. So I would say, Martha was so great, and Martha was wonderful, and this weekend we went to the movies. And I was getting advice about my relationship, because this was my first relationship ever, and I was understanding these things about love, and I didn't want to shut up about it.
Dan, you knew well your sexual orientation upon influence your decision to the military. Didn't you foresee the problems entering point before you applied?
Well, I knew that I was gay since fourth grade. I knew because I was praying about it. I said, I really just want to be straight. And there would be nothing in the world that would make me more happy than to just wake up the next morning and be straight. And I would pray about this all the time. But when I was making a decision to go into the military, you don't make your decision to go into the military so you can be straight or you gay. You want to be something greater than just your own agenda. You want to be a part of a mission that serves others and that stands up and fights for people who cannot stand up and fight for themselves. And that was at the forefront of my mind. And my dad had always told me, and he's from Korea, he's an immigrant, he had said that in Korea, at least, the culture dictates that if you are a 70 or 80-year-old man, an elder in the community, but you've never served in the military, that is, if you have never served something greater than yourself, then you're not treated like an adult. You are treated like a child. And so you don't ever get that respect. And he'd always ingrained that into us. And so I knew that if I wanted to serve something greater than myself, that it had to be for me going into the military.
You co-founded Nights Out. That's an organization you mentioned of West Point alumni advocating for the rights of gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military. You've become a national spokesperson against the current military policy of gays and lesbians in the military. You mentioned some are driven to the point of suicide.
That's right. I really found that among all of the things that we can be fighting for, we really need to step up and speak for those that cannot speak for themselves. I got so many emails from around the world, not just those that are in the military, but all throughout, that are just dealing with this isolation. Some in Afghanistan or Iraq, one of my friends who's right now serving in Korea, she's straight and she has a lesbian soldier in her unit. And when we stepped up as our group of West Point grads that are openly gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, and we send this very simple message to everybody, no matter what you are, you do not have to feel alone, because we have gone through it too, and we stand shoulder to shoulder with you. And for my straight classmate, who's a commander, she just simply let this lesbian soldier know that we existed. And so we've become really a resource for a lot of people.
Dan, in April, this would have been before your trial, you wrote a letter to President Obama. What did you ask him to do in the letter?
Well, number one, we have to remind all of our leaders that we need to restore integrity to the military. If there are any people in the military who have to lie, then it makes the military an environment where integrity is not as valued. And so I asked him, not just on my behalf, but on all of the soldiers that have to go through, and there's, I think, a very conservative estimate of 65,000
gay and lesbian soldiers that have to go through this. I said, on our behalf, do not fire us. And particularly in my case, I asked the president, as the commander-in-chief, do not fire any more soldiers.
Do you believe the president will follow through with his stated intentions to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
The president has integrity. The president has a sense of responsibility. But for the 9-10 months now that he's been in office, he hasn't done anything. He went up in front of the Human Rights Campaign a few weeks back, and I was there, and I heard him say 7 particular words: I will end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And to hear him say that, I had realized, well, that's a cause for hope for me. And he's saying that as a commander-in-chief. However, in the military, I learned to judge people not on their words, but on their actions and the things that they do. And I will believe it when I see it. So I'm going to withhold praise until I see something happen. And all we've seen happen in this year, almost a year since he's been in office, and many people say, give him a break, he's only been in office for however many months. But in those many months, 600 soldiers have been kicked out under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, just because you're honest, just because you refuse to lie about who you are.
In an interview with the Army Times published a week ago, the Secretary of the Army, John McHugh, indicated that the Army would be ready to lift the ban on gays serving openly if both Congress and President Obama decided to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Doesn't that give you even more hope?
Well, we all knew that that's true. Obviously, the Army has gone through eras during the time of the Persian Gulf War where President Bush, the first President Bush, made essentially a stop-loss order go into effect. He said, I'm not going to fire anybody. We are in a time of war. We can't fire people. And so everybody's known that, okay, there are gay people. But then once they came back from war, people said, okay, well, now you have to be kicked out, which is the most despicable thing. So we have to make sure, of course, that we honor all of the service of all of our soldiers. We support all of our troops. And the Secretary of the Army, McHugh, I know him from my time at Fort Drum and the 10th Mountain Division in upstate New York. He is a congressman, and he's a Republican, and he was just recently nominated to take over the Department of the Army by President Obama. And that does give us hope, particularly because he knows soldiers by their first name, and he understands the thing. He listens to the things that they bring up to him.
What are your thoughts, speaking at Iowa State University, coming to a state that now allows same-sex marriage, the third state in the nation, to legalize it?
It's wonderful to be a part of a group of pioneers that aren't afraid to do the right thing. But I know that change sometimes takes a lot of time for a lot of people, and there have been people, obviously, that have expressed their opposition to what I'm doing for their own reasons and their own agendas. And I would say that for a lot of people still, just because we have marriage equality in the state of Iowa or a good number of states now, doesn't mean that the work is over. When you look at all of the many other issues that are surrounding us, you talk about more than 50% of the youth that are homeless in our country on the streets are from the LGBT, the lesbian, gay, or transgender communities. We know that we have so much work to do. And even if we have all of the legal benefits of being who we are, there's still so much of a responsibility. It's not a matter of rights or entitlements or benefits that we can get through laws. But there are soldiers out there. There are young people out there that are so isolated, they don't know if they can continue on with their life. When you come out of the closet, when somebody who's straight talks about their friend who's out of the closet or who's gay or lesbian, it is a responsibility to those people who need to hear that message, and they might hear it at the very moment that they're about to commit suicide, and they don't know if they can continue going on. It's not about rights. It's about our obligation. We owe it to those people to continue telling our message. It is a responsibility to come out.
Lieutenant Dan Choi, I want to thank you for this conversation and thank you for your service to our country as well.
Thank you very much, Ben.
That was Lieutenant Dan Choi. I spoke with him in 2009 about his discharge from the Army under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Last week, he was hospitalized after what was characterized as a nervous breakdown and anxiety attack. Choi released a statement about Congress's vote to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. "No revolution towards justice ever went backwards," he writes. "To all the supporters of equality and Don't Ask, Don't Tell's death, I am so grateful. The road has not been easy. I intend to rejoin the military and serve in any capacity I can be of best use. I intend to marry and have a family of my own. We are living in a truly historic moment where we can enjoy the rewards of our efforts." A statement just put out by Lieutenant Dan Choi. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at this email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.